knew a man, Bojangles, and he danced for you in worn out shoes, silver hair and ragged shirt and baggy pants.
Hi, this is John McEwen. This is the American Music Show, which means we're going to delve into the background of some American music. What's on your mind, Ruthie?
I was wondering about the beginning, the origin, who wrote it. Mr. Bojangles, why don't you tell me about that?
We were very fortunate that we were rehearsing for our fifth album in 1969. And it was our fifth album we were putting together. And for 5 months, we were playing 10 hours a day, 6 days a week in Long Beach, California, trying to figure out how are we going to get back on the radio? Because we had a minor hit and three albums after it that did nothing. Jeff Hanna came into the rehearsal one day and said, I heard this song on the radio last night, and it's just perfect. I think it's perfect for me, but I don't know where to find it. It's called Mr. Bojangles. And one of the guys in the band says, I've got that in my record collection. Well, his record collection was in the trunk of his Dodge Dart that he'd driven out from Philadelphia, and it was under a spare tire. It was one record, 145 of Jerry Jeff Walker doing Mr. Bojangles. And he took it in and learned it and then taught it to us. It's the best way for a group to learn other people's songs. It's not everybody listen to a record. Just have one person teach it to the others, and then they come up with their own interpretation. And we recorded it on that album. And when it came out, it became such a – it was on the charts for 36 or 38 weeks. And it was – an amazing record. The Jackson 5 had three number one songs come and go. Well, Mr. Bojangles went up and down the charts. I asked Jerry Jeff Walker, the guy that wrote it, a couple years ago, I said, how did that song come about? And Jerry Jeff, I was in his home in Austin, Texas. He's quite known as a Texas songwriter. He said, well, I was 19. I was a busker, a street performer. And I was going all over the country, but I always found that I liked New Orleans. It was my favorite place to play in the street. See, Ruthie, nobody had record deals then. It was just a dream. I think this was around 1965 he was doing that. And he said that they'd arrest all the street performers every couple weeks and put them in jail.
Why?
Well, they thought there was too much riffraff on the street. They wanted to clean up the streets, and that way the police could look like they were doing something. And the street performers all liked it because they had a dry bed for a night or two and free food and showers and all that. And they got to hang out with each other. Well, each other was a variety. There might be a trumpet player guy and a juggler and some guy playing a harmonica or somebody beating on a couple boxes or a guitar player. And often there was a dancer. And any dancer in New Orleans, back then even, would call themselves Bojangles. And they were doing that in honor of the original Bojangles, Bill Robinson from Richmond, Virginia. He became famous starting as a street performer dancer and ended up in the movies with Shirley Temple. And he was in jail with all these street performers, and there was a dancer, a guy that actually thought he was the original Bojangles. And as Jerry Jeff says in the song, I met him in a cell in New Orleans. We were down and out. He looked to me to be the eyes of age, and then he spoke right out. He talked of his life and what a life he'd had. It seemed like he'd been everywhere and done everything, and I was a teenager in jail for the first time and not the last. That was Jerry Jeff. But those are some words that aren't in the song, but part of them were. And he later on recorded that song. The street was behind him at this time, and he was trying to make it in the music business. And it came out, somebody at a record company liked it, and it only made it to like number 95 on the charts. That's when Jeff heard it. And it just didn't make it. And I ran into Jerry Jeff the year we put that out. I didn't know him yet, but in 1969, I went to see him in a club in Philadelphia. It's called the Main Point. And there was about 20 people there, and his show was just over, and we'd missed his performance of Bojangles, and he was having what he used to call a wild turkey night, which meant he spent more time on the floor than standing up. And so we heard his version of Bojangles that night and told him we'd put it out. He told me when I was at his house in Austin that it was that night he decided to quit the music business. He was driving back to Florida. He was going to go to Florida and sell hot dogs or hats or something on the beach. And he was pulled over in a rest area on I-95 in Virginia. And he was driving down there with a buddy. And around 5 in the morning, some radio station said, "Here's that new song." And his buddy woke him up and said, Jerry Jeff, that's your song, Bojangles. And he cranked it up and he listened to it. And he said it was that morning that he pointed his car at Austin, Texas, and never looked back. And thanks to a Catholic girls' school, that became a top 10 song. Otherwise, it would have been a top 20 song.
Many people don't recognize, don't know the story behind that Catholic girls' school. That was the most fascinating thing you've said in all of our talks. Everybody called me, emailed me, wrote about it, said something about that producer bringing in groups to entertain the Catholic girls' school. Please tell that again.
Here we were about 20 weeks into this record that made it to the top 20. And in fact, it was about number 14. And it was after quite a struggle because it would go to 18 and the record company would say, "That's it. Next week it would go down to 19. They'd say, "Oh, it's going to be over next week." The next week it would go up to 15. And then, "Oh, well, it's got some new life." Then it would go down to 17 and up to, it finally made it up to 14 because it was starting to get picked up on easy listening stations, and as they were called then, and then country stations. But we were told it's not going to make it to the top 10 because ABC in New York is not playing it. And the way that worked is if ABC in New York didn't play a record, then BCN in Boston wouldn't play it. And most likely the station in Philly wouldn't play it. WLS in Chicago, which means world's largest store, WLS, they wouldn't play it either because it wasn't on ABC. And that's the way Billboard worked the charts. It had to be requests, sales, what people were saying on the phone, and a certain number of radio stations to get to every level. And nobody wants to say they have a top 14 record, so you always aspire for the top 10. Well, we were told by the record company you need to play at Catholic girls' school. Why is that? Well, we just did it because we were told to. And it's not that I don't have anything against Catholics or girls or schools. But picture, we're in the 20th week of a pretty well-known song at this point, and we're playing lunchtime at a junior high school for Catholic girls, and the sister walks in just before we're getting ready, and I ask her, I said, "Pardon me, sister, who else has played your school?" She goes, "Oh, this year we've had the Jackson Five. Boy, are they talented. They sure can dance, and earlier, before that, Mr. Paul Simon was here. What a fine singer. And last year, John Lennon played for us. What a nice boy he was." And I said, "Well, we have an important show to get ready for." And then I was thinking about why we had to play there. You see, Rick Sklar, he was the programmer of ABC. He was the man that determined what record would be put on that really aspired for time chart slot. His daughter was one of the students at that school. We played the show, and I guess it went well, because the next day, ABC in New York said, "And here's a new song by the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band," and it made it to the top 10. And it lasted a total of 36 weeks.
You have to tell them where the school was.
And it's not that I have anything against schools or girls' schools or Catholic girls' schools or junior high schools. This one happened to be in Manhattan, right around Midtown somewhere. I didn't know the city that well then, but it was right in the middle of Manhattan. The Nitty Gritty Dirt Band's career has been a success for the same reason many other groups have had success. It's because of the people, the fans. Groups don't make hit records, is my belief. I'm speaking for others too, I guess, but my opinion is we all record songs. That's what we are doing. And we hope that people like them. But if people didn't like them, they wouldn't be hits. And you put out music and people talk about it and somebody reviews it and somebody plays it and somebody calls and requests it. And it's a very strange process. The people pick the hits. Now, the Dirt Band's career has had several ups and downs. It's kind of like looking, the graph of the Dirt Band's career is like looking at a saw blade from the side, up and down and up and down. We had a hit in 1967, been together 7 months, and Bye For Me to Rain made it to the top 30 on the pop chart. Then nothing, except for one song, it was called Truly Right, that was number one in Yakima, Washington. And we beat out Strawberry Fields. When we played Yakima in late 1967, it was like a window into the possible future. We tried to eat at a restaurant, and we had to get out. There were too many. Oh, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band's in here. They're bigger than the Beatles.
That's wild.
Strawberry Fields was number two, and our record was number one.
Yakima, what does it stand for? What does it mean?
Yakima is an Indian word that I think it means, let's get out of here.
I don't think so.
But it was where a big fair was. So we were up there in 67 playing the fair. So you look for those signs of success. After the Bye For Me the Rain and a few fallow years, we ended up in Paint Your Wagon. We did a song called Hand Me Down That Can of Beans and spent 4 months on the set. That got us a lot of press, no airplay. It was right after that we started working on the fifth album that had Bojangles on it. And that we had a few good years after that, counting the Circle Be Unbroken album, which has been inducted by the Library of Congress as one of the most important American recordings. But the middle 70s wasn't a lot going on till the end of the 70s when we got back from Russia. Nitty Gritty Dirt Band was the first American group to go to Russia. But that was also followed by a couple of fallow years until Jeff Hanna wrote a song called Make a Little Magic. And that got on the pop charts. And then Rodney Krause sent us a song, An American Dream. Voila, An American Dream. And that got on the pop charts. I think that made it to number 9 even. Another top 10 pop record. Then there were 3 more years of nothing. And we'd never, here we are 17 years into doing this, and never had a number one song. That's when Rodney Crowell, the great writer that lives in Nashville, used to be married to Roseanne Cash, he sent me a cassette. He sent us a cassette, and our manager gave it to me to listen to, see what I thought. And I said, man, this sounds like a hit. It was Rodney and his guitar and his wife at the time, Roseanne, singing harmony. A song called Long Hard Road. It was one of those magic times, Ruthie, where when we started recording that song and Jimmy started singing, you felt in the studio like you were listening to something coming out of the radio. And Long Hard Road ended up being our first number one song after 17 years. It was a long, hard road.
I've met people who follow Nitty Gritty Dirt Band and know your history, and it amazes me, the details that they know and the years that they've followed your music.
And one of the strange things about Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, it's one of those groups that when an average audience, you know, when there's a concert, only half the people usually want to be there. And they were brought by the other half. That's my belief anyway, and it seems to hold true. You know, it's like, honey, I'll go to the Barry Manilow concert with you if you go see the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band with me. You know, things like that.
I see.
Or I'll go to the Grateful Dead reunion if you go see Kenny Rogers with me. You know, that kind of thing. So the Dirt Band playing, I can't tell you how many times somebody says, yeah, and I brought my wife, and she stood there and says, I didn't know they did that song. I didn't know they did that song, about 5 or 6 or 7 times a night. Because a lot of the weird name, it worked against us for many years. A lot of radio stations didn't want to say Nitty Gritty Dirt Band.
Neither did I. I have to ask, why didn't you change your name?
Well, after being together for 12, 13 years, the guys decided to change it to the Dirt Band. And that's, to me, it was like 12 years of marketing out the window, 12 years of branding, of logo recognition.
Mm-hmm.
And for about 2 years, we went as the Dirt Band, and that's what the Make a Little Magic song came out under that name. But it created so many problems because the record stores didn't know what bin to put us in. Oh, is this a new group? So now the records were split in two places.
Oh, I didn't realize. I never even thought of that.
And the other problem was people that... Okay, the other problem was exemplified one day when we were getting on an airplane, all five of us filing into the plane. The stewardess said, are you guys in a band? And one of the guys said, yeah, we're the Dirt Band. And she said, I used to really like a group called the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. Are you anything like them? What happened to them?
Oh, geez.
Well, oh, geez. But that night at the hotel, I said, look.
They're all thinking, that's how the typical person would think.
Yeah,
she's speaking for many.
Very few groups can live through a name alteration. Chicago Transit Authority was the original name in Chicago. They changed it about the first year. Little River Band, lots of hit records. Everybody was calling Little River Band LRB. Well, everybody within their circle was, and the promoters and radio people and people around them. So they put out an album, LRB. Nobody knew who it was. It was over.
Oh, my goodness. So what's in a name? That's very important.
We switched back to Nitty Gritty Dirt Band and just lived with it. Now it's just kind of a phrase that comes out. After 45 years of doing this, it's finally had an imprint. And people still call us the Dirt Band or Nitty Gritties or whatever. And it's okay.
Who came up with that name to begin with?
Well, we have time to tell that story because it's very short. The group of guys had auditioned at a club in L.A., before there was any record deal or anything, and won the contest. And the prize was just got to work there for a week for free, got free pizza, and the group needed a name. One guy said, why don't we call it Nitty Gritty Band, because we get down to the nitty gritty. Another guy said, well, why don't we call it the Dirt Band, you know, so it's not bluegrassy. And, well, what about Nitty Gritty Dirt Band? Done. That was it.
Isn't that something? I've always wondered. So tell me.
I'm about 22 in my head, so I'm fine.
But we have good life experience now, which helps us out of all sorts of jams that would have confused us 30 years ago.
Exactly. And like I tell people, you know, you worry about losing the car keys, don't worry about it. As you get older, there's so much more to remember. And do something younger people can't do when you lose those keys. Take the other car.
So true.
In worn out shoes, silver hair and ragged shirt and baggy pants, the old soft shoes jump so high, jump so high, and then it lightly touched down. Back his clothes all around.
and died. Up and died. After 20 years, he still grieves. Said a dance now at every chance.